Welcome to IndieWire's Filmmaker Toolkit Podcast. I'm Jim Hempel. I write about filmmaking craft for IndieWire. My guest today is director Adam Wingard, who returns to the world of Godzilla and King Kong for Godzilla Kong, The New Empire. The movie expands upon and deepens the mythology Wingard first explored in 2021's Godzilla vs. Kong, creating new conflicts, new monsters, and integrating visual effects with some truly spectacular location shooting in a way that I found pretty exciting. So I'm happy to have him here to talk about how he did it. So welcome, Adam.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So I guess my first question for you is, it's kind of a big one, but I'm just curious, going into this, what were the lessons you learned on Godzilla vs. Kong that informed the approach you took here? I mean, from writing to working with all your department heads, who I know were pretty much the same as they were on the previous movie, to even just thinking about how to properly present the Godzilla and Kong characters.
Well, I've had a pretty interesting career in the sense that, you know, I wasn't one of these filmmakers who came out of Sundance or, you know, the other big festivals. I mean, I had movies that played at them, but I wasn't one of the guys that just exploded on the scene and, you know, did a movie or two and then, you know, they're thrust into a big budget, which almost happened a couple times. I almost actually did a sequel to Peter Jackson's King Kong back in the day, because based on him watching Your Next, which was over a decade ago. You know, over the years, my films have kind of progressed budgetarily, and I started with very small budgets. You know, $3,000 was my first movie. So basically that's not even a budget. That's just like paying for gas, you know, and DV tapes. And then I kind of stayed in the, you know, $500,000 to $5 million range for quite some years. And then, you know, I finally had a big step up with Godzilla Kong or Godzilla versus Kong. And I would say making that film kind of fueled, you know, every decision that I made, not just in terms of making Godzilla Kong the New Empire, but even having the desire to make another one of these films, because, you know, there's just no way to plan for the complexity of a movie like this. And like I said, having come from an indie background, I avoided using visual effects and green screen for so many years because I knew other filmmakers who had made low budget projects that tried to integrate visual effects. And the truth is, if you can't pay for good visual effects, they're going to look like crap. So I was always terrified that I would get stuck with a movie that had bad visual effects. And so I just always went practical and found clever ways working around it. You know, so here I am working on this big movie. I can finally afford visual effects. And I get sort of to the end of Godzilla versus Kong, and I felt like I was really just getting the swing of it. You know, like there's so much, you know, not just even in terms of the visual effects themselves, but even just the ins and outs of, you know, having the confidence of what an eye line for a monster should be from somebody on the ground level and everything in between. And I was really inspired actually by an interview that I read with Quentin Tarantino after he did Django Unchained, and they asked him why he decided to do another Western. And he said kind of something similar, which was, you know, he felt like he'd just kind of, you know, got figured out how to shoot a Western and all the things that are very specific to shooting Westerns, like people on horses and all that. And so I don't know. I for some reason, I don't even know where I read that interview, if I dreamed it up or not, but it kept like repeating in my head because I felt like I related to it so much, but just in the context of the MonsterVerse. So, you know, I came into this film knowing really more like, you know, like, you know, how to use the tools and having the desire to really say, you know what, like, I'm excited about really pushing into the visual effects and the animation. And there's only so many ways to shoot giant monsters, and they pretty much all require full CG. And so that was the thing that I was really looking forward to getting into more, because I knew I could push, you know, the kind of animated character side of it.
Well, what about just the people management aspect of it? I'm guessing on a movie like this, the size of crew and post-production team, I mean, it's got to be exponentially larger than anything you work with in the indie world. And I mean, I remember once reading like Steven Soderbergh describing making a big studio movie as trying to paint behind standing behind a jet engine. I mean, how do you kind of keep your focus and sort of communicate what you need across that many people?
Well, it's interesting because I felt very intimidated when I got hired on Godzilla versus Kong initially, about the idea of really even, I'd never been on a big movie set, like a tentpole movie, something that costs over $100 million. I had no idea really what that looked like beyond watching, behind the scenes specials on TV. And Legendary was shooting King of Monsters at the time that I got hired. And so they invited me to the set, and I was, I was very nervous going on set because it was like, what is this going to look like when you get there? Because like you're saying, you do these indie movies and you're used to a certain size. So what does it mean when you get to the next level up? Kind of the biggest level of movies to a certain degree, that once you're over 100 million, that's the tier, right? And I'll never forget, I showed up in Atlanta. And we get to the location. They were shooting in some warehouse that was converted into a soundstage. And I just remember, first off, my first impression was the trailer, all the village of the trailers really expanded out. The footprint was much wider, right? And so that's where I started. I got out there. We hung out at the trailer for a minute, and they brought us a set. And I remember they had a giant craft service, kind of feeding area that was pretty big. And I was like, this is bigger than what I'm used to. But so far, it's all the same stuff, right? And it's just more. And you go on set, and there's just more people around. It's like it's double the amount of people that you're used to, at least. They had all these chairs where all the cast and people, the extras and stuff were waiting in. And, again, the footprint was big, big, big. But what was interesting is I kept getting closer and closer to set, and things started looking more and more familiar until I'm on the actual set that they'd built. And, and ultimately, the set was big enough to just accommodate exactly what you're used to in an indie movie. And that was kind of like an amazing moment, because I realized that it doesn't matter if you're doing a film for, hundreds of million dollars or $5 million. At the end of the day, you're just trying to get stuff in front of the camera and you're photographing it. And ultimately, the crew around the camera is exactly the same. You might have an extra camera or two, and that might require, a couple extra hands, but ultimately it's the same thing. And so all that stuff around the edge is kind of white noise, because as a director, you're not managing that. You're managing the people, who are at the top of the departments, and that's consistent. And so that was kind of an interesting moment. And I felt completely relieved from that point on. I understood. I was like, okay, it's the same thing. So.
Uh-huh. Well, that leads me to a question about how you work with the actors, because I really liked, we'll talk about the monsters, but I liked the human actors in this as well. You've got Rebecca Hall, Brian Tyree Henry, Dan Stevens, a lot of really, really good actors. What kinds of technical challenges are there for them, and what's the environment that you try to create on set to help facilitate their best work?
Well, I'm really fortunate in terms of the whole ensemble we have in this film, that they just got along so well. It's a total coincidence, but Dan Stevens and Rebecca Hall, I think they're roommates in college. Like, they literally knew each other really well. Like, Rebecca's, she's been a babysitter for Dan's kids and all kinds of stuff, So, and that literally just a coincidence. That hadn't, it was just one of those things that worked out. But getting kind of that core group with Brian Tyree Henry and Kaylee Hoddle together, it was just, it instantly clicked. And so they made my job really easy, because at the end of the day, I just needed to kind of let them have fun, because I kind of have a theory about directing a lot of times. And obviously, every actor is different and every actor needs something different from the director, no matter who they are. But at the end of the day, a movie like this one, what's really important is letting the cast, kind of cut loose and have fun, because that really comes off on screen and it adds to the camaraderie. And even if the characters are supposed to be bickering, it's like that friendship comes through and there's a likability to it. And so I try to create a kind of a loose environment. And, there's always there's always sequences, like every week at least. Sometimes the whole week is, half of the set is going to be green screen. We try to always build at least some of the set. Sometimes we're on location. We go to all kinds of different jungles and, you know, crazy places making these movies. But, you know, there are a lot of days where they're reacting to, you know, King Kong, Godzilla, whatever monsters off screen. And, you know, I have to give them a lot of sound cues and, you know, usually have a big PA system set up. And, you know, generally I have a microphone and I'm either just yelling roar or I'm actually roaring into the microphone. And or sometimes I have sound effects pre-prepared and I'll play those on there and, you know, just to help them out. And it gets a little complicated sometimes because Kaylee Hoddle, she plays a deaf character and she's actually deaf in real life. And so, you know, usually whenever you're doing these sequences where they're having to react to something imaginary off screen, you're giving them verbal cues. And so we had to kind of come up with a system where sometimes we had like lights off screen flashing to Kaylee that somebody would hit, you know, whenever I'm cueing the actors. And then sometimes we literally had people on ladders if, you know, depending on the set, you know, waving to Kaylee so she knows when to look. And so everybody's all synchronized and that gets a little complicated.
Well, and so you mentioned shooting in these jungles. And I mean, some of the locations I was reading about you shooting, it just sounded crazy. I mean, there were, I think Dan Stevens was talking about, you know, animals that I'd never even heard of that you guys were coming across. I mean, where were you shooting the location stuff and what does that give you and what kind of logistical challenges does it create having to get a big production in and out of these jungles?
Yeah, well, you know, on a movie like this, it's so important to get as many real locations as you can because, like I said earlier, there's only so many ways to create Godzilla and Kong, and it's through visual effects. And so where possible, you're always trying to put these actors in real places. And so, and I have a great line producer who's very passionate about Eric McLeod. He's very passionate about getting to all these real locations. And so we shot in like something like, you know, most of a second unit, but we were in eight different, I think, countries at different points in this movie. But so of course you end up in really exotic places. We were always trying to find locations that you've never seen on film. And so we like one of them specifically is we went out to the Daintree rainforest, and it was a pretty complicated location. You had to take a ferry that was like across like a river to get there. And I think it was at least an hour and a half drive from the hotel through the ferry and all that stuff, which is a long time out of your day when, you know, you have a lot of stuff to accomplish. And it was a gorgeous place. And, you know, we shot in this one area that had these plants that were like, some of them are literally like 2,000 years old, which is insane to say. But they're, you know, even though they're that old, they were still very fragile. So I'll be honest with you, I was a nervous wreck the whole time we were there because, you know, at the end of the day, a film shoots just like a construction crew at a certain point. It's like you kind of just bulldozer all over these areas. And so, you know, I made sure to have, you know, lots of talks with everybody, really stressing like, we really can't touch this stuff out here. So, you know, we've got all this crazy, you know, techno cranes and all this stuff. And we're, you know, very gingerly kind of like weaving these crazy paths to try to make sure that we're not, you know, crushing anything that might be harmed. And I had some weird experiences in the rainforest, like, and a lot of people did, like when we specifically set out to shoot in this area, we all started having these weird dreams, like vivid dreams, you know, like I had dreams about like the jungle, like all these roots coming out of the jungle and like strangling me. And I would like wake up in the middle of the night. And it was very psychedelic in a way. It was almost like, you know, that the jungle really was like kind of warning us, like, don't fuck with us or we will curse you.
This is some material for your next horror movie. What's the key for you to integrating that real world stuff you're shooting with the CGI so that it's consistent and convincing? Because I felt like, I mean, one of the things I really loved about this movie is that the Godzilla Kong stuff did not feel, I mean, for lack of a better word, fake. Like it felt like they felt like they had, you know, there was weight and gravity to these characters and they felt very well integrated with the environments. And I mean, you were talking about how you kind of, I think, learned a lot about that on the first movie. What are some of the things you learned about how to make that work?
I have a really great DP, Ben Saracen, that I work with on, or I've worked with on both of these films. And, you know, he's very passionate about trying to bring a reality to the lighting and the look of the movie. And specifically, one of the things that we started with that was really helpful and also helped give a very distinctive look to the film is, you know, Ben went to, I can't remember the name of the company. It's one of the big lens companies here in LA, and they actually created a lot of custom lenses for us. You know, like we took all this old glass and they would combine these like warped, you know, lenses. And so we shot with a lot of really crazy looking lenses that were always distorting, you know, not just the edges, but sometimes the whole frame. There might be just one little part of the frame that's really actually in focus. It's very fun for the focus puller, as you can imagine. And, but what's cool about that is, you know, that gave us this sort of this look to the movie that wasn't perfect. It took it out of the digital realm right away. These are also anamorphic lenses. So right out the gate, you're kind of already stretching everything. But then on top of that, all this textured glass. And we scanned that stuff into the computer, and we were able to create a recipe that allowed us to simulate exactly what we did with the lenses. And so whenever we're creating either shots that, you know, integrate with live action or even the full VFX shots, they all have this very specific lens look to it. And you know, and of course we tried to make sure that the lighting, you know, was unique and is grounded as possible. Sometimes it's kind of hard to know what, you know, something on that big of a scale would truly look like and what the, you know, just all the things that entail there. But it was important, I think just starting from that kind of standpoint of imperfection was a great way to get into not just integrating the monster stuff into the live action, but making the full CG sequences, you know, look like they were really shot.
Well, I also really loved the way you used color in the movie, because, you know, often when I don't like a tentpole movie, it's because I find them to have a kind of dark and dingy look. And you went way the opposite way. It's very bright and vibrant and vivid. And I love the use of color. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the thinking behind that and how you worked with the DP and the production designer to create that look.
Yeah, I mean, you know, maybe this is just, you know, doing psychedelics for 10 years straight, you know, back in the day and, you know, being very influenced by extremely, you know, colorful kind of environments. And, you know, I was, you know, I grew up as well, like, you know, really inspired by, I'm obviously a child of the 80s. So the toys and the cartoons of that era really are completely ingrained in my mind. And so I wanted to, without doing a movie that was a cartoon, I wanted to take those sensibilities and bring it to a film that hopefully we could ground into making a reality. You know, so that was like kind of the challenge, is I wanted to take that 80s color palette, the 80s toy and cartoon color palette, and try to bring it into a reality that wasn't just stylized, you know, in a way that would just feel like we're making a big cartoon. And I've worked with the same production designer on all of my movies. It's this guy, Tom Hammack. He's fantastic. I was very lucky to, you know, find him back in the day with Your Next. And we just have a great partnership. And Tom's this brilliant guy that for many years, it always felt like he was this up and coming guy. So every movie I'd come on, I was always like, you know, he's the one guy that I carry over every single production. And I felt like I always had to vouch for him. And at the end of the production, everybody's, you know, trying to steal him away from me because they love him so much. And, you know, he's the type of production designer that really loves to facilitate a director's vision, especially if, you know, we really see eye to eye. And I think he finds my sensibilities exciting. And So we tried to do something that was very stylized, and, you know, at the end of the day, we were also trying to figure out, well, how do we ground that in reality? So, you know, some of the sets might look like, you know, when we design them, it might be like a big military base, and we wanted it to sort of, from the, if you stood back from it, it would almost look like this giant toy set with lots of yellows and reds. But then when you get up close to the pieces that we're building and the actors are close to, you would see that there's all this chip paint and it's dirty and it's got weather damage and all those things, so that, you kind of believe that they would build this stuff. And Tom always had like a, you know, I give him credit because he always took like, oh, hey, you know, whenever I would ask him like, hey, I want this set to be vibrantly red and yellow and this and that. And he would figure out what those kind of actual colors would mean in a industrial or military environment, because you do use bright colors still for different reasons, usually for safety reasons. And so he was able to always integrate that. So it's not just random, but at the end of the day, I couldn't tell you what any of them mean. I just trusted that Tom was figuring it out.
Well, the movie's got a really cool tonal balance, and I'm kind of curious what the challenges are there, because it's a movie where you're, in a sense, having it both ways. You create a lot of stuff that's really silly in a great, fun way, but then you also give it this kind of solid emotional center, not just for the human characters, but for the monsters. What was your philosophy about how to walk that line?
You know, it's funny. I mean, I knew that I wanted this movie to just be, you know, just, you know, kind of a thrill ride. I wanted it to be fun. I think in general, like I think I do my best work when, even though I'd never done a comedy before per se, that the film's kind of borderline on almost being a comedic version of whatever subgenre I'm doing. And so, and also I think with my approach to the MonsterVerse is I'm really aiming for, to me, the target audience is kids. I'm trying to make a movie for what I think I would have liked to have seen anywhere between 6 and 18. You know, like that's like, I think that's like when I was the most impressionistic with movies. And I think in some ways, that's when I enjoyed movies the most. It was so pure. And that's before I knew about all the ins and outs of filmmaking. And, you know, once you kind of are so ingrained in the system, when you watch movies, all you can look at are the shots and, you know, because you know how they're pulling this off. You're guessing like, oh, that's ADR right there. And you just know all these things. And you can't watch movies quite as purely as you could when you're a kid. And that's sort of what I was trying to hit tonally. But at the end of the day, like, you know, when you're making a kid's movie too, or a movie for kids in that range, it's important that you're not going full kiddie, you know? It's like you need to make the kids feel like adults, and you need the adults watching it to feel like kids. And I guess that's kind of how I'd summarize the tone of the movie. Like it's this kind of sweet spot for that.
Yeah, no, that's a great way to describe it. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the things that are new and specific to this movie, like the Suko character, who's kind of a mini Kong. Where did that idea originate, and what were the guiding principles for that character's design?
Yeah, I mean, I think that originated all the way back in the early days of Godzilla versus Kong. Mary Parent, she's the main producer on these films, and Dune at Legendary, and she's fantastic. And I just remember we were having a story meeting, and she was just kind of talking out loud sort of about what the future of the MonsterVerse could be. And she just mentioned, you know, the idea of a Son of Kong movie. Nobody knew what that meant. But I kind of, you know, let that ruminate for the next 2 years. I like the idea of having Kong meet others of his kind in Hollow Earth. So that was the actual starting point. So this Suko character was sort of the beginning, and we kind of built everything around it. You know, the thing about Suko, who's, you know, also known as Baby Kong or, you know, whatever. And the scary thing about doing a character like that is that instantly people are going to be suspicious that you're creating this character to sell toys, you know. And selling toys is a fun, exciting thing. I don't make any money off of it. I wish I did. I could retire. I'm pretty sure if I had some of that, you know, kind of percentages that George Lucas had on his toys in the MonsterVerse. So, you know, there's always going to be this suspicion when you have a cute character. Everybody's going to think of Ewoks and, you know, that whole thing. And I wanted to make sure that we weren't gonna do that with Suko, and Baby Yoda had just started coming out. That was during the pandemic, during that era, and you know, Baby Yoda's cute, but that's what Baby Yoda mostly does, is be cute. And so I instantly was kind of like, well, I want the cuteness of Baby Yoda, you know, because I like Baby Yoda, all right. But I want it to be Baby Yoda if Baby Yoda is going to bite your face off and eat your skin off of your face, you know, like he's a little bastard, you know, like that's what's fun about Suko is, you know, there's a fun moment when he's first introduced in the movie, and you know, Kong ends up kind of, you know, not treating him great. And you feel it's justified because he kind of tries to get Kong killed, and he sets a trap for him. And so it's kind of a fun dynamic between the two, because they're not just going to instantly get along. They in a way have their own little kind of buddy cop dynamic, father son, but it's, you know, maybe more like Homer and Bart than a conventional father and son.
And what about the villain, Scar King? Talk a little bit about the conceptualizing that character.
Well, I think with these movies, the villains are always going to be the most fun part. So Scar King just made sense to me right out the gate. It's like, this is going to be, we're going to, for the first time ever, create a real arch nemesis for Kong. And that obviously has to be another ape. And Kong and his whole history, you look back at it, he's never really had an arch nemesis. Godzilla's had tons of them over the years. Ghidorah, just in the MonsterVerse, you know, Mechagodzilla. And so when creating the Scar King, I wanted this sort of anti-Kong character. And because in the last film we had developed this cool axe that Kong uses, it's made out of this sort of Godzilla-like scale. That became sort of like an iconic part of his MonsterVerse repertoire. And so I knew I wanted to give Scar King something that would be formidable to an axe. And I'm a big fan of the movie Emperor of the North from the 70s with Lee Marvin and Ernest Borgnine. And that movie has a great sequence at the end of the film where, you know, Lee Marvin and Ernest are fighting on the back of a train, and Ernest Borgnine has this cool weapon that's like sort of like a chain with a spike on the end, and Lee Marvin's got like a 2x4. He might even have an axe at the end. I haven't seen it in many years, but that quality of that fight always, it just made such an impression on me. As a matter of fact, I think I've only seen Emperor of the North once, and I've kind of almost been afraid to go back to it because I liked it so much, and just that. The audacity of the ending of that film where it ends up is, you know, that was kind of the influence of Scar King in some ways.
And I'm curious, when you're editing a movie like this, you know, how far along are the visual effects? I mean, you know, are there challenges in terms of, are you editing this movie with a lot of stuff not done yet? And how do you kind of know what you're looking at and know if it's working?
Well, you know, there's an advantage to doing a movie like this, and then there's disadvantages. So, like, the advantages is that right at the beginning of pre-production, I can start making the movie, you know? Like, we might be 8 months away from shooting anything, but I can already start on full sequences. So, you know, before we were even rolling the camera, I think we had almost 15 minutes of the movie that was well represented of the full CG sequences completed, which really helped pace out the film as well. Because we're like, here's a 5 minute chunk, here's a 5 minute chunk, you know, we're working on this 8 minute chunk here. And so that's great, but you can't, you know, catch up to the whole production, because a movie like this, you just have too much. And you're always gonna find certain things shift a little bit as you make the movie. And so you can't quite plan for everything. And again, this is one of those things that, you know, the first time around as a director making a film of this size and this specific kind of MonsterVerse thing, you wouldn't have the skills or know-how of what to expect. But at the end of the day, you have to, like, the actual edit of the movie is constantly filled with both previs, live action. And then you'll have all these black cards that just describe what the action's going to be, you know, and you just get so used to watching this movie where you're like, okay, this is cool. This is cool. Okay, here's 10 seconds of description of what's going to be in this place with music and sound effects over it, just to give it a little bit of life. And then it goes to the next. But luckily, all these producers at Legendary have pretty much been aboard every film since the original Godzilla 2014. And so they know how to watch these movies. And it does require some imagination going into it. And that can be a little scary as a filmmaker, because you have to live with all these incomplete moments in the movie, and everything takes a certain amount of time. Every time you develop a shot, even in previs, you know, it takes days to get it back, and sometimes a week or more, you know, depending on the complexity of it and how many passes. It's going back and forth with the visual effects team before they're happy with it. And you really have to learn to pace yourself making these films, because you're going to spend, you know, almost three times longer than you would on an indie movie. And everything just happens very slowly.
Well, now that you've done it again, and, you know, again, it feels like this one, you had a lot of confidence going in, and it's a really, really fun movie. It seems like you have a real knack for this. Are you planning to do more movies, more of these MonsterVerse movies? Is that what's next for you?
Possibly. I mean, I've been doing these things for 7 years now, and it's pretty all-consuming. I mean, you know, it's hard to imagine how you can spend basically a year and a half editing a film and be busy, you know, 9 to 7 o'clock every single day, but you're constantly working on this thing, and it really fills your time. So these movies can be exhausting, but at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. And I'm excited to do another one at some point, potentially. It depends on, you know, I didn't sign on to this one until we saw how successful Godzilla versus Kong was. And, you know, we'll have to see. I think I would be interested in doing it. Maybe I might need to do something in between, just to reset my palate, maybe something a little smaller. Who knows? You know, it also depends on, you know, if Legendary is looking to do the next one right away, you know, and if, you know, so there's all those factors at play. But definitely I know what I would like to do with the next one. There's been some discussion about it, and I think there's some really exciting monsters that I think people would, you know, be excited to see in with modern visual effects that they haven't seen before. And there's definitely more ground to cover, because, again, like I said, like, the reason I did this one is because I felt like we could push the envelope of visual effects, that we could really lean into something that was even more visual effects driven from a monster's point of view, which means nonverbal visual storytelling, which is an exciting thing, which you don't usually get to do on a big tentpole movie. You're not able to do these long, long sequences throughout the film with nobody talking and nobody explaining anything going on. And sometimes it's 8 minutes of monsters grunting and roaring at each other, but you still understand what's going on. And that's a really fun thing to do. And Godzilla's just picking up so much momentum right now. And, you know, you got Minus One, you got the TV show, you got our film. There's just, you know, even at the premiere last night, it's like, every time Godzilla's on screen, everybody just gets so excited. You can just feel it in the room. It's like there's so much excitement around Godzilla. So to a certain degree, it's like the excitement of doing another one to me would be really like the focus would be like, you know, can we do a movie that's as much about Godzilla in the same way that this one's just as much about Kong, you know, for the next one. So
cool. Well, I hope you do it, because I feel like your enthusiasm for these movies is really infectious. You can really feel it watching them, and it kind of comes through to the audience. And I really enjoyed it. So thanks so much for doing this, for coming and talking to me about it.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.